Ahem. I wish you all had copies of Molly Peacock's newest collection, The Second Blush, which won't be available until June, unfortunately. For it is both a departure from and a continuation of what has made her one of our most important and best-loved poets. Her distinct, confident voice sings, whispers, chats, and prays, and we can't help but feel when paging through her poems that we are Molly's ideal reader. But her scope has moved from raw heaven, the title of her second book, and raw sex and raw smells, alcoholic fathers, the blood, tears, and large raw wounds of childhood to themes that are smaller, not raw, but refined. She has ushered her poems out of the tumultuous bedroom and into the drawing room or the parlor, where she writes of teacups and hand-loomed rugs, paper clips, and quick kisses. They are the domestic poems of a woman who has come to find peace for herself and thrive at last in a peaceful marriage, but who is never smug and who has smartly not avoided conflict. They are kitchen poems of dishpans and artichokes and contentment, but they never flinch from flaws, little wounds, or little sins. Almost always suggesting the sonnet, Molly's poems, like all good sonnets, seek to resolve contradictions, to scrutinize two sides of a coin. They are ultimately the poems of spring at midlife and of possibilities, and as she concludes the title poem, First Blush, possibility plays before us. It fizzles and spills up through consciousness, rolling its April of yeses through groves. It will melt by noon, forcing a green through the naked fields, through us. Molly Peacock is the author of soon to be 6 books of poetry, including Cornucopia, New and Selected Poems, which she has for sale here this evening. Among her other works are How to Read a Poem and Start a Poetry Circle, and a memoir, Paradise, Piece by Piece. She is the editor of a collection of creative nonfiction, The Private Eye, Privacy in a Public World, and the co-editor of Poetry in Motion, 100 Poems from the Subways and Buses. She is the recipient of numerous awards from the Danforth Foundation, Ingram Merrill Foundation, Woodworth Wilson Foundations, National Endowment for the Arts, the New York State Council on the Arts, and a whole bunch of awards that she probably doesn't even remember anymore. Her poems have appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, The New Republic, The Paris Review, and River Styx, as well as the best of the best American poetry. Former president of the Poetry Society of America, she is currently on the faculty of the Spalding University Low Residency Master of Fine Arts program. A transplanted New Yorker, she now lives in Toronto. Please welcome a dear friend and a true and loyal teacher, Molly Peacock.
This is my third visit to St. Louis and my second reading at Duff's and my second reading in St. Louis and a number of people were at the first reading, so I can't do my usual because you already know my usual, so I'm going to move around here a bit. And first of all, thank Richard. Richard is a force in poetry. He's a force here, of course, in St. Louis. He shapes poetic activity here in St. Louis, as all of you know who know him, but also through River Styx. Through 15 years of readings here at Duff's, through 15 years with River Styx, he is also shaping the landscape of contemporary American letters. He does that through his editing, through his organizing, and he does it through his poetry. I met Richard through his poetry. I read his poetry before he became a student of mine, and I thought, wow, I hope that one gets assigned to me. And my wish was granted. So I'm really particularly pleased to be here, and also to have that introduction about my new work. And I'm going to flip back and forth between the second blush, which doesn't look like this. It's going to be turquoise, and Cornucopia, New and Selected Poems. Of night, a city mouse darts from the paws of night. A body drops from the jaws of night. A woman denies the laws of night. Awake and trapped in the was of night. A young man turns in the gauze of night, unraveling the cause of night, that days extend their claws at night to reenact old wars at night, though dreams can heal old sores at night. And spring begins its thaw at night, while worry bones are gnawed at night. He sips her through a straw at night. Verbs whisper in the claws of night. A finger to her lips. The paws of night. That's probably the most intensely quote unquote formal poem I'll read tonight. It's a sonnet and a guzzle. I actually didn't know. Wasn't really thinking about that as I wrote it. But there it turned out to be. Now I had a request on Saturday night, and I'm going to honor that request. This poor person, Karen, has had to wait 48 hours. Boy, I hope it's worth it. I've been thrilled to have there are a lot of writers in this room, and maybe you've had this experience where you send your best poem out and everybody rejects it, and then you send your poem and somebody takes it right away. But when you send Richard your best poem, it's another story. So, needless to say, I like this one, and I read it for Karen. The cliffs of mistake. To know you're making a mistake as you make it, yet not be able to stop, is to step off a cliff, expecting to scramble backward and up through the air to stand on the outcrop you stepped from, even though it can't unhappen, as you backpedal wildly with the second step, looking far, far below onto the moraine of pain you recognize later, but which is now only the shock of anticipating the result there's no leaping back from. Oh God, and this is only a metaphor. Might this be what metaphors are for? to say what it's like before you hit what it is. So now I'll go back to Cornucopia, which are poems about what it is. And I'm going to read another request, a poem called The Little Girls. And I was touched that Catherine, with whom I am delighted to be reading, I have heard her read before, and I knew a little of her work. It's always so nice, so pleasant when you have a kind of sympathetic vibration with your co-reader. So she asked me to read The Little Girls, and I was touched because today, in fact, would have been my sister's 58th birthday, were she still alive. This poem, The Little Girls, of course, is it's about watching two little girls, but of course it's also about being one of them. And here it is. Listening to the voice of an older child informing a younger child of a fact the kid didn't know, and watching the wild parental look of the older one and the act of guarded nonchalance the younger one puts on changes their colored world into black and white. The ordinary chrome of days gets wan, then gray, then just as black as houses at night, door after door shut, black as forgetting. The older one's helpless face contorts in its official meanness, hungry and aggrieved. The younger face, after the brief bloodletting, a high-pitched minute of mocking, reports in for adult ammunition. Both are bereaved. Just to follow that up with a poem about grown-up anger. It's called Anger Sweetened. And I don't know. For those of you who are writers here, the thing about giving a poetry reading is that very often the people in the room are practitioners of your art. People lament this, but I kind of like it. It means that the people in your audience know what it is you're up against. This is a poem called Anger Sweetened, and I wrote it having woken up with a bizarre image in my mind. And almost the kind of image where you just sort of brush it away thinking, well, no one's ever going to get this. How can I do this? I thought about the image from your daughter's dream in that way, and the sort of challenge of how to do that. I think about James Merrill's poem called The Mad Scene. That begins, last night I dreamed the dream called laundry. This doesn't have a dream, but it's just got this strange image in it that I felt that I had to I was just going to say coagulate. I had to incorporate. But maybe incorporation is kind of coagulation, I don't know. Anger sweetened. What we don't forget is what we don't say. I mourn the heaps of anger covered by quizzical looks, grasshoppers covered by coagulating chocolate. Each word like a leggy thing that would have sprung away. We caught and candified so it would stay spindly and alarmed, poised in our presence, dead, but in the shape of its old essence. We must eat them now. We must eat the words we should have let go, but preserved, thinking to hide them. They were as small as insects blinking in our hands, but now they are stiff and shirred with sweet to twice their size. So what we gagged will gag us now that we are so enraged. And in another childhood poem, I keep invoking Catherine. We also happen to have discovered that we're both from Buffalo. I just can't believe it. And we grew up, you know, we grew up within miles of one another. I mean, and also within some distance in age, obviously, but the space was the same. So I have to read a poem called Buffalo. Of the thing that you identify most with Buffalo, other than snow. Many times I wait there for my father, in parking lots of bars, or in the bars themselves, drinking a cherry Coke. Father, joking with a bartender who ignores him, except to take the orders. I think of the horrible discipline of bartenders and how they must feel to serve. How some shrink from any conversation to endure the serving, 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 and disease. I think I would be one of these, eternally hunched around myself, turning to appease monosyllabically in the dimness. To flee enforced darkness in the afternoon wasn't possible. Where was I to go? Home was too far to walk to. My balloon, wrinkling in the front seat in the cold, too awful to go out and play with. Many times I wait there for my father, stupefied with helpless rage. Looks old for her age, any one of the bartenders said. Outside, the wide, endlessly horizontal vista raged with sun and snow. It was Buffalo, gleaming below great lakes. Behind bar blinds, we were caged. Some motes of sunlight, cathedrally beaming. So that's a little, you know, what can I say? The bar and the church, so to speak. Okay, I'm going to flip back here to from Cornucopia to the Second Blush, and go on. I gave myself an assignment when I wrote the poems in the Second Blush, and the assignment simply was 14 lines, single image. I did it because I'm really busy, and I cannot wait for some idea to materialize out of a blank page. There may be writers here who wait for these ideas to materialize, but I feel like in that respect, I'm kind of, I approach poetry at like a sport. I mean, you've just, you know, you have to get out and play. You got to do it, whether you feel crummy, whether you don't feel crummy, you've got to get out there and play. And so how am I going to play? I have to invent a couple of rules. Now, I hardly ever got the 14 lines exactly, and I hardly ever got the single image. That was harder. Didn't say one single image, but here there is one that predominates. And it's highly alliterative, and it's going to pop this microphone. It's called Pink Paperclip. A pink plastic paperclip lies prone on the corner, pardon me, on the counter. Its curve, return curve, out of reach of the dishcloth. I miss it as I swipe the crumbs into the trash with my ruthless urge to order. My husband comes by. I've got a foster home for paper clips, he says, and takes it to his room, to a little box where it waits in readiness, the color of a girl's barrette. I might have chucked it. And this is why the gods terrify me. Yet, they merely interest him. Among all the other beings in the world, including me, whom he still finds useful, even inspiring my new goal to personify everything, each in the bloom of its use, finally becoming a poet after all. Also continuing the cat theme, our minor art. We make love better unobserved. Not that we'd ever throw the new cats off the bed. We let them sit there, turning their backs, but listening anyway. We don't move in bed quite with the freedom we might have without them. But the fact that they stay is like being visited by minor gods. And we love the minor. It inspires us because we like being close to its genius, something we might come to understand beyond our, pardon me, beyond our human bounds, but near to our kind. Not like the major, a capitalized god, for instance, or uppercase art. Those things are beyond us. Yet, our transformation here in bed is art. Something best made unobserved, even by the cats who leap off as we forget them. And and ourselves. I'm just looking at people and thinking that I had a mother who couldn't bear when you repeated yourself. She would say, "Oh, you told me that yesterday," or "You're going to tell that story again." So I am going to repeat a couple of poems because I just can't give a poetry reading without them. I'll take a chance on this one. This is a poem called "Vision in the Back Seat of a Taxi." As she flung the insult, she saw my face and apologized as our taxi lurched into traffic. "Not my finest moment," she said. And then I looked down to find my minor wound healing, even as I laid eyes on it, moving through stages of the fresh cut, the blood coagulating, a scab forming, as if a child had fallen and gashed her knee, then watched it mend in fast-forward motion. I forgot her, close by my side, too busy marveling at my rapid recovery from the insult, until I turned to see her face, almost completely covered in pus. A wound opened again, attempting to repair. The yellow-green cells summoned after each slur spattered back like pan grease from a fire far away from the moist day we rattled through the city with our taxi window open. By the time we bumped downtown, even my scar had faded, as if all the years I lived had erased it. Then we heaved out of the sagging seat and opened the battered yellow door onto the dusty road that ancient Philip of Macedonia traveled, saying, "Lo, each traveler you meet carries a great burden." I'll continue on here, read one, and then read a couple more from Cornucopia, and we'll be done. I did read this last night, because I'm thinking of my sister, I am going to read it again. It's called "The Blanket." It's another one of those single image 14 lines. Obviously, it goes beyond 14 lines. But here's the single image. And there's no way I can... This is a new book, and I can't look it up in the... There's no index in the back, so I'm going to have to find it. As you can see by these pieces of paper, I said this on Saturday night as well, I was thinking about you. And thinking about what I would like to read. And you know what? It doesn't give the page numbers, so I still have to look for it. I'm finding it. Here we go. Okay. But as I was saying on Saturday, and I say again to those of you who weren't there on Saturday, you plan for these things, but then you get into the room, and all of your associations change, or you run into somebody you haven't seen since 1989, or You see faces that you saw before, and they're here again, or something new and intent on somebody else's face, or somebody mentions why I'm not a Buddhist, or so all of these things shift around, and because a poetry reading, unlike a theater performance, and I do a bit of acting as well, it's mutable. And there's something, for me, there's something sort of marvelous about it, because as an actor, of course, you can never see your audience. But as a poet, I get to see you. The Blanket. It has a subtitle, Antarctica. I woke to the voice of my dead sister. She was cold, she said, colder than she'd ever been in life. 8 years dead, freed from being used by our father, or so I thought, until I heard her. You, by the door, ready to leave this poem. Stay with me. Here I am, demanding that you listen.